Let's see.
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, my name's April.
Hi, April.
Hi, I just got home from work, and
safely,
I find it very ironic and very horrible that somehow our leaders, our misleaders, have kind of turned MLK Day around. For one thing, they always celebrate it on the Monday following, so that a lot of people aren't even aware of the real date of his birthday, January 15th, every year. And you see closures, and you see Martin Luther King Day activities split between the 2 days. And it's also pretty horrible that Martin Luther King was about helping everyone.
Absolutely.
The last people he was working with were the garbage workers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was starting a poor people's campaign, which is why he was killed.
Exactly.
And yes.
Now the only people that get to celebrate the actual holiday, not his actual birthday, because I did celebrate on Sunday going to two different things.
Nice.
But the only people that actually get to celebrate his holiday with a day off are not the people he was helping.
No.
They're the people with, you know, better jobs.
Right, the bankers.
Actually get holidays off.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And what Martin Luther King means to me is not just celebrating one day a year, but celebrating every day. That, you know, by working together, it may be, you know, our causes may be really unpopular, but by working together, we can keep struggling and we can have vision, and someday we'll get there.
Absolutely.
I agree, and I think from how I feel, at least in our area in Portland, I feel like our mission is super popular, at least among the crowds and people that I meet and shake hands with. You know, it just seems like the people with the money, the people that are supposed to be elected to represent us, it seems like they don't. They just represent the people that pay their campaign financing.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true to a very large extent. But one thing I did notice is, you know, KBOO always advertises the big Martin Luther King celebration at Highland Church.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great, but that's on the 16th. They don't say anything about his birthday on the 15th. And I don't know, I may have missed it, but did KBOO even cover the Take Back Martin Luther King Day event that I believe was in Peninsula Park?
You know,
I'm not sure. I can't answer that question because I've been busy at work. We're actually volunteers that do this show
the third Monday
of the month.
I understand, but I mean, I guess my point is that even KBOO seems to be buying into that a little bit. And that's not, you know, any one person. And I know we all have a responsibility to, because it is volunteer run, to be on the board or something, try to change things like that. And, you know, I've really been thinking about that a lot this year. However, you know, I think it is a paradigm. And just to say that it's only the people in power that are feeding into it is not accurate.
No, that's true. There's a lot of people that are misinformed. And I feel like, but I feel like the people in power send that message out to them.
Right,
and a
right.
lot of people are buying
Definitely.
It. We don't buy it.
And I think it does have to do a little bit with what we were talking about earlier, which is that if we aren't educated, if our system of education doesn't provide that to us, then we are misinformed from the get-go, and therefore we get to this point in our lives and we still don't have the ability
to...
Oh,
right.
sorry.
I think that's true. I mean, a lot of people that I talk to, especially people who are younger, but a lot of people my age too, don't even know when Martin Luther King's birthday is anymore.
Exactly.
My birthday happens to be on the 15th, and I told...
So you remember every year.
Yeah,
right.
You know.
But I told a coworker that, you know, well...
I'm getting
Martin
the look.
Martin Luther King and I share the same birthday, and she said...
Prison pipeline
Oh,
time.
Is it on the 16th?
You know, unfortunately, our time is up here.
We're out.
Thank you for calling.
I'm getting the luck. We're 3 minutes over. It went by so fast.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you so much for calling in, April. Hope you have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.
And happy post-birthday.
For everyone else out there that's listening, this has been Labor Radio. Thanks for spending a half hour of your time with us, or 33 minutes, actually, this time. And we'll see you next time.
Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now.
Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. This evening, we're here with Daniel McGowan. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Adam?
Hey, pretty good. Thanks for being on. Daniel is a former political prisoner. And Daniel, based on your experience as somebody who's politically incarcerated, And last week, a few weeks ago, we had some folks from Project Censor who were working on stories, the news that didn't make the news, talking about CMUs. And you were somebody who has directly experienced that. You've written on it. Can you talk about the experience? Can you say a little bit about CMUs for anybody who might not know what that is in the first place?
Yeah, sure. Well, CMUs are communication management units. There are these units run by the Bureau of Prisons, established in, I believe, 2006 and 2008 at USP Marion and USP or FCI Terre Haute in Indiana. They were started underneath the Bush White House as sort of this place to put people with so-called terrorism cases, people that perhaps couldn't be put at the Supermax prison in Florence, but people that they wanted to kind of bury, sort of prevent access to the media, prevent access to supporters, as a lot of the folks that are in the CMU were East Coast and West Coast folks. The communication management units were essentially restriction units, punishment units in a way, and they were definitely experimental. The idea was essentially, I was at a low security prison, getting visits, playing softball. I don't want to make it sound too great, but it was, it's prison. You're away from your family and friends. You're restricted. But I was able to kind of do an academic program at Antioch University. I was able to walk around and do my time, so to speak. The CMU is remarkably different. When I got there, they only had one phone call a week, and you had to schedule that phone call about a week and a half in advance. Obviously calling people with busy lives, you can't always predict when someone's going to be home. So, you went from having essentially 300 minutes on the phone per month to having like 60, which was shocking. Kind of cut out your support base by making it so you can't talk to anyone. Then they also, what they really did that was harmful was in essentially squashing our contact visits. And so when you're in a regular federal prison, you're able to, have contact visits. You can hug your wife or partner, play Uno, eat ice cream, have like a 7-hour visit. People come all this way to see you. It kind of makes sense that they would stay for 6-7 hours, 3 days in a row, whatever. And the CMU, what they did is essentially they gave us one visit a month, and the visit was 4 hours. And the visit was in this tiny booth that, essentially fit like one person, with a camera overhead, with people live monitoring the phone call or live monitoring the visit from Washington, D.C., from the so-called counterterrorist unit. So those were two of the worst aspects of the CMU. The other aspect was there was no real idea of how long we would be there. We were told various things by different staff members. When we finally got around to suing the Department of Justice in this case called Aref v. Holder, or now I guess Aref v. Lynch, it became pretty apparent through discovery that they actually had no real policy. They were just putting people there and not really devising a way to like that people would actually get their way out. There was no due process essentially, and there was pretty severe retaliation for expressing political beliefs. So I had, when I was at the low security prison, I had written a bunch of articles about current events, the drug war, life in prison, some like mundane stuff, and then also pertinent stuff. And those specific words I used, those like blog posts that I made, were used to essentially put me in the CMU and keep me there. And I did a total of 48 months at CMU, 26 at Marion and 22 at Terre Haute.
So, Daniel, the first question simply is why? When we talk about the CMUs, why such extraneous conditions compared to other prisons? You know, when we disambiguate the types of prisons that are out there, you know, there's Supermax and there's so on and so forth. So what's so unique or special about these CMUs? What's going on?
Well, it's hard for me to like represent the opinion of the BOP, like why they went, sure. But it seemed like everything was rushed, was very fast, and just they opened the units and they kind of just shoved us in there, and then they worried about making the units like habitable. And, you know, they literally were like, the Terre Haute CMU was essentially the old death row. So the death row had been closed. It had been, you know, they had killed Timothy McVeigh. They had moved it. And then they had just shuttered the unit. And so for 3.5-4 years, it was just empty. So they get criticism. I believe the Bureau of Prisons got criticism by the Inspector General about how they deal with so-called terrorist inmates. And they quickly, just very fast, ramped up the unit, opened it up, and just shoved, you know, 18 men in there, 16 of whom were Muslim. And just kind of like, put the cart before the horse. So some of the conditions, I think, was a result of them just moving so damn fast to comply with, the Attorney General or whatever. But, and then some of it was just like, you know, animosity that they had for the people who were in the unit. Like I said, largely most people were Muslim. People like myself who had, on paper terrorist cases that, you know, clearly are at odds with the people that work these units and people that work for the Bureau of Prisons. So there was always a lot of like animosity and nastiness directed towards us.
So it sounds like on some level that one of the MOs with the CMUs perhaps has a lot to do with not only political incarcerations, but things that are fitting under, you know, the title, you know, of terrorism, which in your case, it did according to the U.S. government.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So can you say more about that?
Well, I think I fit the perfect storm of, when the first CMU was open, it was 16 of 18 people were there were Muslim. So when they opened up the second one, they petitioned, you know, the various prisons and said, do you have any good candidates that, that have terrorism cases, that are troublemakers? And, at the prison I was at, I actually never got in any trouble, but I know I received a lot of mail. I know that I was on what they call the SIS list, which is the internal detectives at the prison, like read your mail. So all my mail would get there late and in like a huge bundle. And I know that they were well aware that I was doing this academic program in the library. It was totally above board. It was actually a sociology master's. But the stuff I was writing about clearly could not have made them too happy. Right. I mean, it was writing critically about activism and about stuff that I was involved in. So, and the fact is I was not Muslim. So it was very easy to take me and just stick me in there because I just fulfilled a lot of their little quotas. Because they could put me in there and then say, hey, see, he's not Muslim. The whole unit's not Muslim. We got, you know, we got an animal rights activist. We have an environmental activist. We have a sovereign citizen, one of the right wing dudes. But it's always been 66% Muslim. So.
Right. Can you say more about those relationships? Because that's very interesting as far as which I always refer to that kind of segregation is of course, a form of, you know, colonialism in itself. Right. Divide and conquer, you know. So how did that play out over those years between you and other prisoners and then between each other, you know, different groups and of course, having these everybody, it sounds like, including yourself, having these very precarious kind of cases and charges.
Well, it's interesting. The unit had a lot of published authors. It had a lot of people that had college degrees, which is very rare in my experience in prison to meet someone that has been to college or whatever. I think they thought that we were all going to be at each other's throats, but I just, you know, to me, it was a much quieter unit. People were like less, quiet in terms of just how like loud and yelling at the TV and stuff. And so I actually really liked most of the people that I was in prison with, at the CMU. I found them to be really interesting people. And I learned a lot about Islam and about other parts of the world. So I generally just treated people with respect and I expected it my own way. I definitely felt You know, other than a 6 month, 5 month period where I had a friend, and it's Andy Stipendian from the Shaq case, mm-hmm. actually not just a friend, but a homie like from yeah. Long Island. I was, you know, felt pretty alone, I would say. You know, there's, you know, it's like I said, it was largely Muslim, but the Muslim population is extremely diverse in terms of like ethnic backgrounds or where they're from in the world, who's American, who's sure. born in
right.
Pakistan or, you know, Yemen or whatever. But it, you know, so that was interesting. There was definitely periods of time where I just felt really lonely. Like if I walk in the TV room, I think I saw like same-sex marriage became legal in New York mm-hmm. and I walked in and I just kind of, you know, a little obnoxiously gave like a kind of slow clap, you know, and, you know, which pissed off like some of the people who were definitely not of that belief. You know, that was a good thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So, right. There were moments where like things happened where I was just like, damn, I don't have anyone to celebrate this with, or sit in there and like, sitting next to someone and say, hey man, you're on TV. And I look up and there's something about the film that was made about my case and kind of just laughing about, like, there was a lot of moments like that where you'd be sitting there, and people, you know, like their case would be discussed on TV, on CNN. And you're just sitting there like, this is truly bizarre, you know?
And that's the case for some of the Muslim prisoners as well?
Or absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I was, you know, I was in with, the funny story I always tell is I think I was at Marion, and, they showed, it was Obama had just gotten in and he had just, you know, gave the kill order to kill those Somali pirates, like on television.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the SEALs, you know, shot up the Somali pirates. Well, you know, about a month later, there was the surviving pirate, and they show mm-hmm. him, they, for whatever reason, I don't know how they're able to do this, they extradited him from Somalia to New York City on piracy laws mm-hmm. from like the 1700s. And I remember when they showed him get off the helicopter or whatever, I said, oh man, this kid, he's going to end up in the CMU. Mm-hmm. And I kind of forgot about it. And then when I was at Terre Haute, like 20 months later, when they were all locked in our cells and we come out for dinner, there's the kid that was on TV.
Wow.
You know, wow. And that was a pretty common, those kind of things happen. You know, there was a Supreme Court case at one point called Humanitarian Law Project versus Holder.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the material aid statute that basically says that you're not allowed to help any group that the U.S. government considers a terrorist group, even if what you're doing is essentially like buying, like literally soccer balls for children right. in Gaza right. or blankets.
Sure.
Right. And so I did time with almost all of those men, the Holy Land Foundation, mm-hmm. people that were given right. 65 year sentences for, like I said, buying sporting goods. And like, because essentially the government's caca theory is that, you know, if you're buying soccer balls, that means that Hamas could go and buy more guns, but
right.
never mind the fact you're talking about like a democratically elected, you know, group. And that's supposed to mean something to the U.S., I suppose, but it doesn't. And so it's pretty interesting to meet such well-traveled, interesting folks, people that, you know, a lot of the people that had entrapment cases were on no kind of path that they were about to blow something up. You know, it's all about right. the U.S. government manufacturing these cases.
Yeah, well, you know, you come from a background before going inside of doing some aspects of, you know, good prisoner support, political prisoner support, jail support, what have you, then going inside and then having somewhat of a base, I mean, not inside, but outside for your support. And what did that landscape look like in the sense of how these other folks were getting supported or not, and or legal, good legal support, good legal advice and things of that nature?
Well, I mean, I would say, yeah, like you said, my support was really strong and I was really lucky to have that. I had a really dedicated group of people in New York and beyond. They made my life a lot easier, mm-hmm. you know, with lawyers and money for commissary. And I mean, it's embarrassing, but I had books, you know, sent to me, like enormous amounts of books and subscriptions and stuff. And I, you know, so it was always kind of shocking to see the difference between myself, like a newer prisoner, someone that just come in, and other folks. And it was really, you know, for me, it was about, I had to like remind myself of it. I feel very bad right now, but basically, you know, I have it so much better than other folks, and anything I can do to help people out, either through better access to organizations or pen pals or lawyers, I would do. I would say that people in the CMU had more access to the courts. A lot of people had fresh cases. They had new cases. They still had lawyers that were willing to help them out. But it, you know, I saw a lot of people's families disintegrate while I was there. You know, the lack of contact visits is really tough for people that have a partner or children. And I would see friends of mine would go to visits and then just come back pretty crushed because they, you know, they saw their children who drove up 13 hours from Dallas and then, you know, they couldn't actually, you know, hold their children on their lap or whatever. And so a lot of people, I saw a lot of divorce papers get filed and I saw a lot of people just mentally spiral downward.
For folks really just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And we're here with Daniel McGowan, who's a former political prisoner. And we've been talking about communication management units and many of the individuals, including Daniel, who had political incarcerations and very extraneous cases, complicated cases, to say the least. Daniel, you're also somebody who is very familiar and very active on many different levels with the general cause for long-term U.S.-held political prisoners. So we've talked a lot about these different cases in the CMUs, and then also, you know, in you're in New York, these back in New York and in upstate, there are so many of these particular prisoners. Can you talk about them and their cases, some updates, landscape? What are some of the organizations and what have you?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, we're lucky in New York to have a lot of organizations that work on mass incarceration, you know, groups like RAP, Release Aging People in Prison, and Correctional Association and just different groups like that, Anarchist Black Cross. So in New York State, we have a situation with some former members of the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, that are still in prison, specifically Jaleel Muntakim and Herman Bell and Robert Seth Hayes. And then also there's David Gilbert, who is a former member of the Weather Underground, that's doing 75 to life for his participation in the Brinks robbery in 1981. So the situation we have right now is that the first three people I mentioned, the Panther men, went to the parole board in 2016. They all were denied. They all given what's called two-year hits, so they get to go back in 2018.
Right.
All of them are in a stage of appealing that denial. Currently, Jaleel is at Attica, and Attica has been messing with him a lot. And the most recent thing was Jaleel is in the secure housing unit, the SHU, right now because he was teaching class on Black history, and they got to the 60s, and Jaleel gave a presentation on the Black Panther Party. Of course, the prison like records it all. Prison got mad about some stuff Jaleel said, and so now he is in the SHU for what seems to be like 4 to 6 months. I was unable to figure that out. He's in the SHU. He is also, like I said, appealing his parole denial from 2016. Robert Seth Hayes has been in prison since 1973. He's at Sullivan Correctional, which is also upstate. He has a medical campaign that's been going on trying to get him an insulin pump, something that, you know, for people on the outside would be pretty easy to get, even through, you know, Obamacare or whatever. And that would help him regulate his insulin. The government, the docs, as they call it, the Department of Corrections, has been pretty you know, gnarly about giving him this, even after the doctors say that he requires it. So there's been a call-in campaign, and he recently released a big open letter online talking about his various legal efforts. The third person that I've referenced is Herman Bell. That's Jaleel's co-defendant. He is at Great Meadow. Had sort of a tough year. I think the government used this law called the Son of Sam law to freeze his commissary account. And presumably to then give some of that money or whatever to the so-called victims of the crime. So it's been kind of a tough year for most of those men, having all been denied parole. Recently, Maliki Shakur Lateen, who is a former Black Panther, was released from prison after 35 years. He has a release fund online at, I think it's rally.org/Maliki. It's M-A-L-I-K-I. And like I said, David Gilbert, the situation is he is on originally a 75 to life charge. This last week, his co-defendant, Judith Clark, received clemency which now allows her to go to the parole board in the first quarter of 2017, which is amazing. And I'm ambivalent about it because of the fact that Judith does not identify as a political prisoner, which is ultimately of no consequence to me. But there's been a series of articles in the New York Times where Judith's lawyer and a racist reporter named Jim Dwyer have a sort of in promoting Judy as the ideal person to receive clemency, they've also then thrown Judith's co-defendants under the bus, specifically Mutulu Shakur, who was supposed to be released in the early part of 2016, but this article ran, and then it appears that Mutulu's date was pulled back, and then he was given a parole hearing in which he was denied parole. Mutulu Shakur has been in prison for 35 years, Tupac Shakur's stepfather, and a well-known political prisoner. So that's sort of the deal right now. Jaleel has a lot of writings that go up on his website. It's freejaleel.com, and I believe Herman's is freehermanbell.org. But, you know, most of this stuff could be found on, like, the New York City ABC website. It's nycabc.wordpress.com. And we're basically, you know, continue to push for, you know, clemency, parole, whatever it takes to get these guys out. You know, they've been in so damn long, and I have a lot of respect for them, and they should be out by now. So.
Sure. So, Daniel, when Bill Clinton was leaving office, had pardoned just a few people, a couple of them from the Puerto Rican independence movement, which now there's one remaining, Oscar Lopez Rivera.
Exactly.
And there was a few other people that Clinton pardoned. And then, of course, in the last couple of years, right, everybody had – their wheel spinning around Obama was going to do something, right? And clearly that's not happening. Now we're in the official age of Trumpism, or whatever you want to call it, right? Maybe you have some other anecdotes you'd like to offer on that. But again, moving forward and talking about this work, because again, in this case, it's changing. The landscape of activism changes. The society is changing. The perspective is changing. The leadership, well, quote unquote leadership, is changing. Right, the lives of the prisoners are changing as far as the conditions, their own health, and what have you. So, I mean, kind of on the ground right now, what do you see maybe happening? I mean, as far as maybe just the grassroots activism, and or maybe, you know, larger national endeavors that might be happening or that might be going to happen for, you know, 2017 on.
Well, I think, you know. Yeah, the age of Trump, fascism, whatever we're going to call it. Yeah. I think things are going to get a lot worse for the federal prison system. I think that, you know, like you said, Obama is out of office in 2 weeks. If he doesn't give office, he's going to leave your post here. He doesn't give office, he's going to leave your post here. Oscar Lopez Rivera, their chances are released. I think for different state prisoners, I think for different issues, things are not going to be totally different. Things are not, people are in prison, and people are in prison is a real place to be. But I don't think that Trump necessarily means that Trump necessarily means that and pushing on a lot of the same problems we've been pushing on. I know in New York State, I don't feel like it. I know in New York State, I don't feel like it. On the issue of the older prisoners, on the political prisoners, I know. Older prisoners, in terms of big things for the year, in terms of really happening for the year, I don't really have. I'm constantly seeking out hopeful things and interested events or trends in order to not feel hopeless right now.
Yeah.
Obviously, things feel pretty gnarly. We've got 2 weeks before the inauguration. I'm happy that people are going to D.C. To challenge the spectacle that is this inauguration. I don't think we all have to go to D.C. I think we could do our work where we are necessarily.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's going to be, you know, I know the whole, like, oh, 2016 sucked and whatever, but I just think that doesn't mean that 2017 is going to be much better or worse. I just think that,
right.
You know, we've been here before, maybe not, maybe this is a whole new thing, but we're going to have to learn new ways of fighting back, I guess.
Sure. Well, you know, as we're kind of wrapping things up tonight, and some of the things that are ongoing or that can be, you know, you're very, what's the word I want to use? It seems like you're a social media guy. And so there's that piece. there's the on the ground organizing, the prisoner writing events, maybe people are doing speaking tours. There's other resources that are produced and available that inform people about political prisoners, such as the calendar. So you want to maybe wrap up talking about a few of those things, what that looks like on the ground, and
again,
maybe just mentioning some of the links again before we're closing out.
Yeah, absolutely. My go-to link for most political prisoner news is the New York City Anarchist Black Cross website. They have a really wonderful illustrated guide to political prisoners. It's at nycabc.wordpress.com, and they're on all those different social media apps as well. I work for a project called Certain Days. It's a Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. You can find it at certaindays.org. We actually just sold out, and our online orders are not going through, but apparently the Anara's info shop in Portland still has some copies, which is great, as well as just a bunch of info shops and stores throughout America that still has it, but you can check out the website for that. And that is a calendar that is started by Herman Bell and David Gilbert and Robert Seth Hayes, and it's a benefit for a bunch of different prisoner organizations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think those are my top two links. But definitely, you can find those two, ABC and Certain Days, on social media as well.
Yeah, how is the calendar organized? Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yeah, sure. Well, the calendar is, like I said, it's a project with the three of the political prisoners I mentioned, and then we have two individuals in Canada and myself, and we have like a network of people that are editors and helpers and readers and such. We distribute the calendar through AK Press and Chris Lebedev in Canada. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it's, as soon as we wrap up 1 year, we're already on the next year. So, like, we're wrapping up 2017 distribution, and we are, like, already having a conversation next week about what the theme is going to be for 2018. Mm-hmm. And it's a benefit, and all the proceeds go to three different programs. It's Release Aging People in Prison in New York, a group called Adamir in Palestine that does political prisoner work, and then the Unistoten